Okay, about a month ago, we started this discussion or this talk on snatching away, or what's commonly today called the rapture. This was as a result of a midrash we had at Shavuot, and so never really came to anything conclusive, so I thought we'd give a few little details on what this is all about. So, we're going to do a little review of what we talked about. We're going to ask the question, does the Bible support the concept of a rapture? And as I said last time, in Messianic Judaism, this concept of a rapture is somewhat taboo anymore. I think it's mostly because of a desire to be different than what you came out of. And so, if you came out of a church that keeps Sunday Sabbath, you want to do, as a Hebrew roots person, you want to do Saturday Sabbath. So you're always doing something sort of different than what you did before. And so I think this is basically why this has become such a thing here in the Hebrew roots movement. All right, so in our review, what we found last time was that much of the concept of the rapture comes out of 1 Corinthians 4, around verse 15. And so what we did last time is we took and looked at what the book of 1 Corinthians is all about, sort of even know why Paul was talking about these things. And once we came to that understanding, we found that Paul was writing to answer basically about three questions they had. One question was, how do we express brotherly love to each other during the times of the tribulation? Because they thought, as we know, as we read through the New Testament, we see many cases and examples where the disciples as well as the people believed that Messiah was going to return quickly and in their day. In fact, in Acts chapter 3, we find that everybody was basically joining their foods, all their valuables together in order to take and be a people when the Messiah returned, which they thought was going to happen very quickly. We know the story of Ananias and Sapphira, who basically gave their land to this walk, or this work, you might say, of preparing for the return of the Messiah, which they thought was imminent. And so there's a lot of questions in regards to what you do during these times leading up to or during the beginnings of the tribulation. How do you express brotherly love to each other? And Paul's response, part of his response is everybody should get a job and go to work and not just sit around and be a leech on everybody. So that's part of his answer to that. We also saw that there was questions about the fate of those who would be alive at the return of the Messiah. What was going to happen to them, and so he talks about that, and that's how we basically get the rapture idea. And then there's also a question about the birth pains of the Messiah, and are they going to be going through the birth pains of the Messiah? So these are the basic three questions. We don't find the questions in the book of 1 Corinthians. We only find the answers to the questions, and so we're just taking and looking at the answers and being able to sort of somewhat come up with the questions based on that. We also see that in from the last teaching that the word in the passage in 1 Corinthians, I say Corinthians, it's Thessalonians. 1 Thessalonians 4, around verse 15, there's the phrase, we shall be caught up. That phrase, we shall be caught up, is the Greek passage harpagesometha. And anyway, that word harpagesometha is derived from the Greek word harpazo. Okay, and harpazo, Strong's number 7026, it basically means to seize or carry off by force. All right, so we were talking this morning about leaving Egypt, and I made the comment that the Israelites did not leave Egypt. They were forced out of Egypt. So you could say that they were harpazoed out of Egypt. And this this idea of harpazo, as used by Paul, carries the connotation of something that is violent. It's a violent removal. It's a violent removal. And that is why the concept of violence is why we also get a word from the Greek word harpazo, and that word through the Latin is the word rape. And so, because this is a violent thing itself. And so there are people who will try to take and liken the concept of a rapture to rape because of the connection of the two words. And you just, person needs to understand that the root word of rape is the same root word as harpazo, okay? And so it's, or actually harpazo is the root word. And so this, the Latin connection, that's all there is to the Latin connection of it. It doesn't mean that this concept of a taking away is likened unto rape, okay? It's not the same thing. All right. We also saw that in the Tanakh, or the Old Testament, there are numerous passages regarding the birth pains of the Messiah and that the people of God would be hidden away during all or part of the birth pains of the Messiah. And then we also saw, by reference to Yeshua's use of the word of the story of Noah and the story of Lot in the Olivet prophecy, that Yeshua is showing that during the times leading up to the tribulation or the birth pains of Messiah, that just as it was in the day of Noah, God prepared a place for Noah to be in or to go to in order to avoid the calamity. He also, in regards to Lot, he took and actually physically grabbed Lot's hands and his wife's and his two daughters' hands and pulled them violently out of the city of Sodom and placed them close to a mountain so they could avoid the calamity that was already coming upon them. So we see Yeshua himself using this idea of a violent, forceful removal from where you're at during this period of time and of calamity. And as we remember, you may not be aware of this, but it's historically we have found that the believers in the New Testament, or in Yeshua in the New Testament times, you know, Paul's, the apostles go to the Jerusalem Council and say that there is myriads of Jews who believe in Yeshua and keep the Torah. Well, those myriads escaped the siege of Jerusalem in 70 AD because they did what Yeshua said and they fled to the mountains. And so Yeshua actually instructed his people that when you see the calamity come, you leave it. You get out of it. God does not expect for us to be trib troopers. How many of you heard that term before? Trib troopers. Okay. Yeah, there's, in fact, I know people who have a email address, tribtroopers.something-something-something, or at something-something-something. And so I'm not a trib trooper. I don't like pain. Okay. And how many of y'all like pain? Okay. So I'm not a trib trooper. What I want to do today then is go through now, let's see, one more thing. As a result of the study on this, we're trying to find a Hebrew word that goes along with harpazo, the best Hebrew word I found that would be similar to the word harpazo, the Greek word harpazo, is the word lakash, which means snatching away. So in my terminology, I use the term, instead of rapture, I call this the snatching away of the people. Now, this is a significant term because the word lakash in Hebrew, you can look it up, it is oftentimes used in reference to becoming married. That a man will go and take his wife. And the Hebrew word there for taking a wife is lakash. All right, so how do we get this concept? And how do we make this term fit in? Well, that's what we're going to do today, is see how this all ties together. And the way we're going to do that is we are going to study the Hebrew wedding. Now, It is very important that we have a good concept of the Hebrew wedding. There's a number of reasons why, but the primary reason why we need to understand the Hebrew wedding is because the Bible is a book that's all about a wedding. It's all about a wedding. In fact, we'll show some scriptures here that we are actually the bride part of the wedding if we are believers in the God of Israel and walking in his way. And so it's important that we understand it. But unfortunately for most of us, our only concept of a wedding is the wedding that we had ourselves or the weddings we see on TV or the Americanized weddings, right? Okay. If we went to someplace like China and witnessed a wedding, we would see that it's probably much different from ours. Though there are a lot of commonality between various weddings, because basically all wedding cultures are in some way tied back to the Hebrew wedding culture. And in fact, where did the concept of a man taking his daughter down the aisle come from? Anybody got any idea? Okay. You turn to Genesis chapter 2, maybe chapter 3, and you see that what God created or made Eve out of the body of Adam, what did he do? He took her to Adam and said, "She is your wife. Now treat her like a wife." Okay? So God started the whole concept, the father taking the bride to the groom. And so there's all of these cultural things. We don't really see where they came from, but they're all through the scripture. We had a person one time come and ask us if they could borrow our hoopah. We got a little thing that we made. We call it a hoopah. But I asked them, "Why do you want to use a hoopah in your wedding?" And they say, "Well, I don't know." And I said, "Well, this thing has some meaning to it." You know, all of these things have meaning, and it's good for us to understand what these are. So we're going to talk a little bit about the Hebrew wedding, because I would submit to you that if we don't understand the Hebrew wedding, we cannot understand the New Testament, at least many things that are said, because so many things that are said in the New Testament are said in the context of marriage or the marriage ceremony. So, Hebrew wedding. We've got to become familiar with it. So first thing we want to see then is that we are indeed in the midst of a marriage system. God's people are going to be married to God. That's just the way it is. And so I'll show you a couple of scriptures in that regards. One is Jeremiah 31:31. This is the new covenant, okay? "Behold, the days are coming, says Yahweh, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt. My covenant, which they broke, though I was a husband to them." So God is our husband. Israel is the bride. Okay? And it's interesting what God said when he took them out of Egypt. Where does he do? He took them out of Egypt by his hand and led them. And if we understand what the concept of salvation is, salvation is when someone takes and removes you or removes a bad situation from you or removes you from a bad situation. And then because this person has removed you from the bad situation, you cast your eyes upon that person and then you marry that person. And the best example of that we have in the scripture, in fact, the first example we have of that in the scripture is when Moses was in Midian and he was just coming into Midian and he met the daughters of Jethro. And they were by a well and they were being harassed by other herdsmen. And it says that Moses took and basically got rid of these guys single-handedly. And the word that says that he delivered or helped them, the Hebrew word there is the word yasha. And yasha is the root word for the word Yeshua. And Yeshua is our salvation. So what he did is he removed the problem that was causing pain upon these girls. And then the oldest girl turned around and did what? Married him. Okay? So that's the whole concept of salvation, that you marry the one who redeems you or delivers you from a bad situation. And so God took Israel by the hand, and I would dare not say, y'all come along. I would dare say, let's go. Because that's the way God deals with people. People are sometimes reluctant to follow God. Is that true or not? Okay, it's a truism. A lot of people are reluctant to follow God. All right, so that's one passage. Ezekiel 16 is another one. 16:8, when I passed by you again and looked upon you, indeed your time was the time of love. He's talking to Israel and Judah. So I spread my wing over you, my kanaf, my tzitzit, you could say. I spread my wing over you and covered your nakedness. Yes, I swore an oath to you and entered into a covenant with you, and you became mine, says Yahweh. So here's another passage here that implies a covering or becoming the covering for a woman. All right? And all of us men are supposed to be coverings for our women. Or woman. 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 Okay? For our woman. All right. So, and then there's this other passage, Isaiah 54, verse 5. For your maker is your husband. The Lord of hosts is his name. And your Redeemer is the Holy One of Israel. He is the God of the whole earth. And so these passages here help us to at least get a good glimpse of the concept that this is all about a marriage. And that God is our husband and we are the bride. And so if we understand that, then we should be able to understand how the wedding is going to be choreographed. Now, how many of you brides didn't have anything to do with the planning of your marriage, of your wedding? All of you had everything to do with the planning. And so we as brides, and it's hard for guys to somehow get this concept in our minds, but we have to be wedding planners for our own wedding. We got to fill the role that our bride is. At least we've got to know enough about it to where we know what's going on, when and while, now, when and where, and what's coming up next. So this is these passages help us to understand that. So let's talk a little bit about the wedding customs of Israel. And let me say it this way. We need to talk about the ancient wedding customs, okay? Because we need to understand how weddings worked in the days that these words were written. And modern Jewish weddings are not the same. There's similarities to them, but they're not the same as what was done back in the times when these things were penned. And so we need to understand what those things are, the way it was done back then. And we'll also see that in our Americanized Christian weddings, much of the same thing that's done in a Jewish wedding is also done in a Christian wedding. So the Christians cannot say that they did not learn this stuff from Judah. They did. They learned a lot from Judah. All right, so let's look at the wedding. There's a number of steps in a Jewish Hebrew wedding, and some people have 12, some people have 3, you know, but basically there's various steps along the way. I like 7 because it matches up with the festivals. I think the marriage matches the festivals really well. And we'll talk about that first. The first step is a covenant or courtship. Most Hebrew weddings in the old days were arranged marriages. And there was 2 reasons why they were arranged marriages. Number one, it was very important that a man have children. And it was very important that the man have a male child somewhere along the way, okay? So a man cannot have children the right way unless he's married. And so it was always planned at a very early age for these young men to get married. Now, women also had a need for marriage. Basically, in the culture of the day, a woman could not be on her own. She just could not survive on her own. And so without a man to help her, take care of her, watch over her, and help provide for her, then she could not make it. So it was very important that they get together really, get together. And in a ancient Hebrew culture, when two people got married, it wasn't just those two people got married. It was two families that got married. And so oftentimes what would happen is that the father of a young person, maybe 6, 7, even 8 years old, just a young child, the father of a boy would get together with another father who had a daughter, and because he knew the family, he knew the integrity of the other father and the other mother, they would arrange for their children to marry when they became of age, old enough. And it was all based on the fact that I know you, so therefore my son can marry you because I know you, and I know you are going to teach your children, and I'm going to teach my children, and so our children then will be compatible. And so it was families that got married, and that's why God tells in the prophets that we are to take and teach our children and our children's children to obey these words, because it's a family that's married to another family, and it's all one unit that God looks at. And so this is the concept of covenant. Now, in a covenant or in a courtship, and I put covenant and courtship together because they are pretty much the same thing. When I decide that my son is going to marry his daughter, then I have to make a covenant with him, and then I also have, though, then to be responsible for making sure that my son and his daughter are also compatible in regards to likes and dislikes and stuff like that. They have to get to know each other. That means then I have to get them around each other every once in a while so that they can be buddies. Can you imagine growing up and you're 8 years old and this boy is 9 years old or the other way around, and you're out there playing in the dirt, but you know that someday you're becoming husband and wife? I mean, I think that could be a good thing, And so, because now you're trying to really figure each other out. Whereas nowadays, you can meet a girl and 2 months later you're married to her, and you don't know the foggiest thing about her, okay? And so, it was a good system back then. Obviously, it's not going to work today. Just too bad. It just doesn't work. So anyway, in the Hebrew wedding, when the husbands or the fathers came together, it's not husbands. When the fathers came together, they would make a covenant with each other in regards to the children. And what would happen is that the father of the groom would have to pay what they call a bride price. Hebrew word is mahar. A bride price for the daughter of the other father. And the reason for that is that, remember, these girls are not only there looking pretty, they're also washing dishes, husking corn, weeding gardens and stuff like that. So you have to pay the other family because you're going to gain a worker and he's going to lose a worker. And so you pay them off to keep the things balanced. You got to keep the scales balanced in everything we do. And so this is why a bride price was paid. Now that's changed it's changed as it went on, but this is anciently how it was done. So that's the first step. It's covenant and courtship, which could be an 8-year-old courting an 8-year-old or a 10-year-old courting a 10-year-old. It could be a 16-year-old courting a 16-year-old girl. The bottom line is that you've got to get to know each other. And we want you to know each other. Even though we've arranged for you to get married, it's not a matter, in some ways that they could make a decision. I just simply cannot stand this guy. He's a real jerk. And so maybe dad would try to buy himself out of the contract or something like that. But in most cases, you got to know each other. And as we know in the story of Rebecca, Rebecca was asked if she wanted to go back to go back with Isaac. But Isaac was never asked if he wanted Rebecca. So it looks like she has the opportunity to opt out, possibly, but it looks like the guy is stuck. All right. But he's probably stuck in a good way because this is the way God designed all this stuff. All right, so let's look at the next thing. Next step is betrothal. All right, so you've made a contract for this woman. The father has made contracts for this woman and this boy to be together. And it may be years later that they actually become betrothed to each other, though. And so the Hebrew word for betrothal is orasa. And it comes from the Hebrew word aras. And I was trying to find the etymology of these words to get a little bit deeper meaning of them, but I couldn't find anything there. Maybe someone can find that out sometime down the road. But anyway, that's the Hebrew word for betrothal is aras. And in a betrothal, Hebrew betrothal, once you become betrothed, and that's basically when the now more mature boy and more mature girl are ready to become actually betrothed to each other. They're at a point in time that they can make decisions on their own and stuff like that. At that point, their marriage, when they become betrothed, they are married. Okay? Though they have not consummated their marriage, they are married. And in order to get out of that marriage, they have to get a divorce. That's the only way you can get out of it, even though they have not consummated a marriage, even though they've not spent a single night together. Once they have betrothed, then they have to legally get a legal document to get out of it. And that's why we see when Joseph and Mary had been betrothed but had not come together yet, in order for them to break that separation, he was going to have to get a bill of divorcement, or he could have simply put her away. And the New Testament seems to indicate that he put her away privately. In other words, he stayed married to her, but they never had a sexual relationship. And so, but anyway, once you betrothed, you have to have that. Now, a betrothal includes what they call a ketubah, and a ketubah is simply the written terms of the marriage. And the oftentimes the fathers will help construct this ketubah based on how this boy was raised and based on how that girl was raised. Say, for instance, in my ketubah, I'll just give you my ketubah. If Angie and I had taken and had a ketubah before we got married, mine would say, I want peanut butter sandwiches and Ruffles potato chips for lunch every day. Okay? And if it's in the ketubah, then she would have had to make sure that I had peanut butter sandwiches and Ruffles potato chips. And you see, Angie doesn't ask for anything. So we could have just had anything because Angie's so easy to get along with. So anyway, but a ketubah, that's what it is. It's you make and say what's going to happen. Not only does it say how you're going to, the terms of the marriage, it also has listed in the terms of the divorce. Okay, it's a prenuptial agreement of the old times, and so if you were going to get divorced for any reason, it was already spelled out how that divorce was going to work. So this is what we have in a ketubah back a long time. It was simply a marriage contract, and everything was just written out. And you've probably seen pictures of ketubahs. I would dare say that they were more detailed than even the ones that we see in modern-day Messianic or Hebrew or Jewish Judaism. All right. Now, after the contract is signed by both and they drink a glass of wine together, which basically confirms the covenant, then the groom leaves the bride behind and he goes to his father's house and he builds what's called a huppah. Now, this is where a lot of people get a lot of false understanding about Hebrew weddings because they've never imagined anything like this. Here you're betrothed and then you're going to leave oftentimes for a year or more. Well, that's what happens. He leaves for a long period of time, at least almost always at least a year, sometimes 2 or 3 years, to build this huppah back at his father's house because his father wants him to be prepared to be able to house her take care of her. He wants her him to make sure that the boy has a trade down real well so he can support her, or he's a good herdsman, or he helps build the herd, or whatever it's going to be. But he leaves for a long time, and he goes and builds this thing called the huppah. And we've talked about the huppah before. And let me see. Let me make sure I don't have anything specific on that. All right, so he's off preparing the huppah, and the girl there, she's staying at her father's house, and while she's there at her father's house, she's preparing herself for marriage. And so she's gathering all the stuff together for the wedding, but also she's learning the things that her husband wants. I mean, she's looking at the ketubah and said, okay, this is what we've agreed to, and so I need to go find where the Brookshire's aisle the peanut butter is. And so she's getting all this stuff worked out so she can be a good bride. So she's doing some work as well while he's gone. She's not just sitting there and twiddling her thumbs waiting for her hubby to come on back. Because at that time, he is her hubby. All right, so after the betrothal, the next thing is, next thing is what we call a stealing of the bride, or the catching away. This is part of the Hebrew wedding, okay? The Hebrew word for this state of a Hebrew or Jewish wedding was back then and is still today called nisuin, okay? And the word nisuin comes from the Hebrew word nasa, and nasa means to lift up, or carry away, or take, okay? So, in the nisuim, or the catching away, what happens is this. The father has told his son, okay, you can now go. I think you're prepared enough. I think now you can go, and you can go get your bride and bring her back. Okay, when he leaves to go get his bride, and he's going into town, he's not going just by himself. He's going with his best man. Today we call it best man, or the friend of the bridegroom. He would be going with him, plus his entourage, all of his friends and everything. And the way this works, and this is how we get the idea of catching away. When he goes into town, he's announced by the friend of the bridegroom, or his best man, who is blowing a shofar to announce that the bridegroom has now arrived. And all of his friends are going in there and they're shouting and everything like that. This is the signal to the bride that, hey, your husband's here. He's coming to get you. All right? At that point, the father of the bride basically turns around, walks out of the house, or does something because his daughter is getting ready to be stolen. They call it the stealing away of the bride. She is stolen away and taken back with him. This is an interesting thing. I didn't know this today. I didn't know this before, but I was trying to figure out a little bit more about this. And, you know, in practically every culture in the world, they have this. It's not called stealing. It's called kidnapping. Okay? But in various cultures, that is how you get a bride. You go kidnap her. And now in most of the cultures, it's an arranged kidnapping. But that's the term that's used for it. And so the man just simply goes to where he wants the girl he wants, and apparently she knows about it, and pulls her away. That, by the way, is also the basis for what we call a honeymoon. Okay? And the reason is because if the father didn't really want this guy to marry his daughter, and he came and kidnapped her, he couldn't take her back to his house because guess who knows where he lives? The father. And so what they would do is they would go off someplace else and spend a month or two before it's good time for daddy to get calmed down a little bit before he'd bring her back. That's the basis for what we call today a honeymoon. And so All this stuff is in our culture. We didn't even know about it. All right, so the groom arrives with much fanfare. He's accompanied by a friend of the bridegroom as well as many friends. And there's a shofar shouting and all that stuff. And he steals the bride and he takes her away to the huppah. And again, the father sometimes would just sort of turn around because this was part of the culture. This is just what they did. And so when Yeshua or anyone else talks about stealing the bride, it's not that we should think that this is an illegal activity. This is just part of what they did. This is just their culture. It was a snatching away of the bride. All right, so where did he snatch her away to? Well, he snatched her away to that huppah that he had built at his father's place. It was oftentimes just a room in the father's house or adjacent to the house or maybe an outbuilding, a barn or something. He built this place in the barn or whatever he's doing, a place for him and his new wife to take and spend the first 7 days of their marriage. The Hebrew word is huppah is het, pei, hay, and it actually just simply means it's a covering. And so you've seen these huppahs. They're those four poles with a covering over the top. That's a modern day huppah, but in an ancient huppah, it was actually a room that was stocked full of food, everything they would need to enjoy the first 7 days of consummation of their marriage. Now, during that time, the marriage was consummated, and also there is the proof of virginity that was given to the father of the bride for safekeeping. And we know in the book, I think it's Deuteronomy, where it talks about that, if a man says, my daughter was not a virgin, then the father is to bring the proof of her virginity. Well, that proof of virginity was gathered on their first night together. All right, so, and then the father would keep this because it would be the evidence that might keep his daughter from being executed if her new husband decided he didn't like her and wanted to try to get rid of her. So this is important. So here he is. They're in the huppah, and they're in the huppah for 7 days. There's a number of references to that. One that comes to mind is when Jacob and married. Was uncontracted to marry Rachel, but ended up with Leah. And Laban asked Jacob to fulfill her week. In other words, stay the 7 days in the huppah with Leah, and then you can have Rachel. And so he spent seven more days in the huppah with Rachel this time. And so this is all scriptural-based stuff that we're looking at here. Okay. Then after the time of the huppah, this is not a real in-depth study of this. I mean, we could go a lot deeper. Then there was the wedding supper. And it was a seven-day celebration. Some people say that concurrent? That the seven-day celebration was concurrent with the 7 days of the huppah. Others say it started at the end of the 7 days of the huppah. But anyway, at the end of the 7 days of celebration for the Hebrew wedding, then the new bride and groom begin to build their own house. They would leave the huppah and go to wherever it's intended for them to take and build their own house. So anyway, that's the general, quick and easy understanding of a Hebrew wedding. But the point we wanted to see in that is that there is a point in time in a Hebrew wedding that the bride is actually caught up, snatched away from her father, or from her father's house, wherever she's currently living, and taken by the groom back to where his original home was. And they stay there for 7 days of the huppah. Now, let's look at some of the parallels to the Hebrew wedding in the New Testament. I only got two right off. There's a number of them in there that we could find. I just wanted to bring up a couple of them. One is in the term nisuim, or lifting up. In Mark 13:32, Yeshua says this of his father. He says, but of the day and the hour no one knows, in other words, the day and the hour when he is going to return, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. Because it's only the father who can tell the son when to go fetch his wife. And so when Yeshua says no one knows the day or the hour, then he's talking about a Hebrew wedding. He's talking about the time when no one knows when he's going to go get his wife. Not even he knows when he's going to be able to go get his wife, because only the father knows. And in the culture, it's when the father says, okay, you're ready, she's ready, all right, now y'all can begin to build a family together. And so this is the whole concept. By the way, that sort of helps us to understand what marriage is all about. Marriage is for the purpose of one thing, that is to build a family. And so this is why we get married. I didn't say this earlier, but in an ancient cultural, Hebrew cultural wedding, your emotional state has really nothing to do with if you're going to get married and who you're going to get married to. You don't have to love the person. And as Angie and I were talking not too long ago, I mean, you really learn to love a person when? After you're married, okay? You're generally infatuated before the marriage, but you learn to love the person when you're sleeping next to someone who snores all night. And you've got to make it work, okay? That's love, okay? So this is when you learn to love. Huh? No, Angie doesn't snore. Neither do I. I just know of people that do snore. I go to prison at night, and on the way, I have to digress here a second. I go to prison at night, and I listen to XM radio, okay? And at XM radio, they have this guy called Rick at Zipa.com. You know what Zipa is? It's Happy Z, spelled backwards. That's the way the commercial goes. Zipa, Happy Z, spelled backwards. Zipas are anti-snoring devices, okay? And if you heard this jerk there that advertises for these things, it's crazy, okay? Absolutely crazy. But they advertise these things about every 2 minutes on XM radio all night long, okay? And I listen to that for 2.5 hours on my way back from prison. And I'll be listening to Zipa commercials tonight. So that's why it comes to mind. All right, so this Nissan lifting up, this is what Yeshua is talking about right here. Hey, what's that? What did I say that was so funny?
We were all thinking, well, that's why you don't snore, because you use a Zipa.
Oh, I use a Zipa? I don't know if I can afford a Zipa. They won't even put the price of these things on the radio. Are we okay?
Yeah.
No, she just gets out of bed. Woke up this morning at 3:00. And my wife had been raptured away. And so, what kind of feeling does that give you, you know? So, all right. Here we go. All right. Another one is the huppah. Yeshua says, in my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. And so the mansions that are being spoken of here are the place I have prepared for you to come to. I was often taught that these are offices of governmental offices and roles and stuff like that. But that's not at all what it's all about. It's all about the fact that Yeshua, by saying this, he's saying, I'm going to prepare a place for you, which implies what? That I'm going to come back and get you. Okay? And so this is the whole concept behind this. This is what kept the disciples from going fishing and staying fishing, because they believed him when he said this, that he was going to come back and get them. So this is the idea behind it. So anyway, this is the couple of passages here where we see this Hebrew wedding culture in the New Testament. Now, the culture is also in the festivals. All seven festivals are here. I think I got it shown with eight. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. No, seven. Okay. So, but the covenant, God's covenant with Israel, basically, it started at Passover, but actually it started Passover about 250 or 300 years earlier when the cutting of the covenant took place. When Abraham cut the covenant with God and God walked between the pieces. That's when the covenant was made, and that's traditionally done, was done on Passover. And so we know then that in the Exodus Passover, that the Israelites came out of Egypt because of what? Because God remembered the covenant he had made with Abraham. And so the covenant idea of marriage begins with Passover, which is also when our redemption took place. All right, and then there's a courtship, and that courtship took place from the moment they left here and they got to the Mount Sinai. And there needed to be a courtship there because Israel, even though this guy saved them and brought them out of Egypt, they really didn't really like the guy too much, okay? They didn't like this God that had brought them out of Egypt. And so they had to get to know this God a little bit along the way. And as we find out, they did get to know him, at least to the point that when they got to the mountain, they were willing to become betrothed together. This is when they had to say, I do. This is when they had to drink the wine. Okay? Because before, this covenant was weighed between who? Abraham and God. Israel had nothing, the bridegroom had nothing, or the bride had nothing to do with this. Okay? But when they got to here at the betrothal, they had to agree to this. And she had to theoretically drink the wine. Okay. So the betrothal starts at Shavuot. Then we have a period of time between Shavuot and the Huppah, because we'll remember that at Shavuot in 32-33 B.C., or Common Era, C.E., A.D., that what happened to the bridegroom? He left. We've not seen him since. Okay? So he left there, and then the next festival's coming up is Yom Teruah, okay? And that is when he comes, according to tradition, and snatches away his bride and brings her back. You know, we go back to this passage right here where it says, this one right here, but the day and the hour no one knows, not even the angels in heaven. Let me ask you, why does it also, why? Not just because of the fact that only God knows, but why is it that this is the day that no man knows? Look at Yom Teruah. When does Yom Teruah always fall? New moon. It's the only festival that starts on a new moon. And you don't know that the new moon is there when Israel was spotting the moon. You didn't know when Yom Teruah was until you saw the new moon. So it's the day that no man knows for two reasons, because it's the new moon and because God is the one who determines when you're going to go back and fetch your bride. So this is that's Yom Teruah and the Huppah are tied together, because this is when God's people, this is when the bride enters the Huppah. Okay? She's taken from her father's house and taken to the Huppah. And then on Yom Kippur is when she would then leave the Huppah 7 days later. Actually, that's 10 days between it in our reckoning. But the idea is that on Yom Kippur, she leaves the Huppah and immediately, or, you know, there's a little bit of time difference there, but almost immediately then goes to what? The wedding feast. And the wedding feast is during Sukkot. Okay, and then after Sukkot, we have a new beginning and all that type of stuff. So, there's actually there's 2 days right here. That's why. No, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Yeah, okay, that's right. All right, so anyway, this is basic Hebrew wedding culture as it ties in with the festivals. So let's, for the sake of what we're discussing, can we see then, when we go back to 1 Thessalonians 4, and we see when Paul talks about a catching away, and how it's timed in there with the birth pains of the Messiah, which we call today the tribulation, how these things could be that he is going to come snatch his bride away, take her to the Huppah, be there for 7 days, and then come back and establish the kingdom of God. That's the idea, that's the concept that I see in the festivals and in the Hebrew wedding and what Paul's saying, how it all ties together. So let's review this a little bit. The Bible is a book about a wedding, and so it's important that we understand it. The ancient Hebrew wedding tradition includes a point when the husband snatches away the bride. And then the festivals, especially the festival of Yom Teruah, when there's a big shout, you know, a shofar blast like there was in the Hebrew wedding, when this all takes place. So, with that, Shalom Aleichem. Have any questions? Scott. Well, you could say that in regards to his I think he was more specifically working with his disciples, getting them to truly understand who he was and what he was doing. And so, yeah, you could say that in effect. But Yeshua is the groom for all of the followers, all of his people. And so we're all in that courtship phase. We're all in that phase right now between the time that we have become betrothed and the time that we go to the huppah, because this is the time when our husband is not... our husband's not here with us. So, yeah, I think the get-together thing, I see what you're saying there. Yeah. In the circle, how it fits the circle. Yeah, that probably wouldn't be the courtship there, because in the process of a purpose of a courtship is to get you to the point that you're willing to say, I do. Okay? Now, after the time you say, I do, now you've got this waiting period. All right? I think that's where we're all at the waiting period. And so for his disciples, they had to say, I do, before they would become his followers. So they said the I do before that, and now for them even, it's this period of time where they're preparing themselves for the catching away, and he's preparing the place for them. That's the way he gives it to us. So. All right, anything else? All right. Well, if you got any questions, we're not stuck on this. I mean, this is a constant study, so.
Yeah, it's my understanding that when you cut ketubah, really, what you're really entering into a covenant, a virtually an unbreakable covenant.
Well, in the Hebrew culture of today, the Jewish culture of today, you could say that's the case, because the Jews don't really follow the ancient culture. But the ancient culture is when the fathers made the contract they made the covenant. Abraham made the covenant with God, and we have no choice. God's people, Israel, when they went to that mountain, they were going to say, I do. Okay, because God said he had already made the covenant. So, no, the ketubah, which many liken the ketubah to be the Ten Commandments that were given at Mount Sinai, that's the terms of the agreement. That's the term. This is how we're going to conduct ourselves between each other. And the ketubah is worked out after the covenant is made. So, yep.
Yeah, when we were looking at the
Yeah. Jennifer? Okay, there's God, what it says in Jeremiah 3, verse 8, it says that God gave a, it's a Sefer Keratot, okay, it's a book of cutting, is what it actually literally means, a book of cutting. And it's basically, this is the paper I'm giving you, because he would have been required by law, by Deuteronomy chapter 22, he would have been required by law, if he was going to divorce her, to give her this paper of cutting. Okay? Now, carefully reading Jeremiah 3, it says that he gave this paper of cutting, or what he was going to give this paper of cutting, or she wanted this paper of cutting. It's sort of ambiguous right there. But Judah didn't. Okay? So, at best, the northern tribes got this divorce. The southern tribes never got a divorce. Okay. Now, the question comes in here. Was there actually a transfer of this paper from one to the other? Because it says that you got to take the paper and put it in her hand. Okay. And the question is this. It's sort of an ambiguous understanding of the Hebrew, is, was it he who asked or who was going to give it, or was it she who asked for a divorce? Okay? And if she asked for a divorce, it seems to imply that he would not give it to her, which would mean that Israel is still married. Okay? No, because God, the contract, this is a little bit of confusion. Israel is one people that are divided into two kingdoms, okay? But the contract, the covenant that God made with for Israel was with Abraham, and it was for one people, not two peoples. Okay, so the offspring of Jacob, no matter if you're from the northern tribes or the southern tribes, is Israel. But what we're basically speaking about, though, in regards to Israel, is what Paul calls the Israel of God. Okay? It's the remnant of Israel. Because it's only the remnant that's going to be saved. So just being born Hebrew doesn't mean you're part of the Israel of God. So God is going to have one bride. And that bride is going to be the Israel of God. Now, there are going to be what we call bridesmaids, which I believe are going to be part of rest of Israel as time goes on. The rest of Israel. As they turn to worship the God of Israel. Bottom line is, no guy wants a woman who's not going to be submissive, who's going to rebel against you in everything she does. And so God doesn't either. And so he's looking for a bride who wants to do as he wants, because he's got it all figured out and she doesn't. So, okay. Make sense? But I know what you're saying. It's the Jeremiah 3:8 thing in 3 verse 8. Yeah, see, Isaiah 50 says, speaking to Israel later, says, okay, Israel, if you think you can go out and run around and marry some other guy, where's your bill of divorcement? Yeah, because if you don't have a bill of divorcement, then you can be executed for messing around with some other guy. And that's why God required Israel, if you're going to divorce your wife, you give her a bill of divorcement, because now that meant that he could never say, hey, you're sleeping with my wife. And because she would say, oh no, I'm not your wife. I've got this bill of divorcement. And this is something that God put in the Torah that prior to that time, the Middle Eastern nations were basically governed under a code called the Code of Hammurabi. Hammurabi. I used to say it a different way, and Houston's shown me how to do it right. So Hammurabi. And in the Code of Hammurabi, if a woman got a divorce, she wasn't given anything. And if her husband finally saw her with this other guy, he could say, oh, she's my wife, have her executed. And so God required the men to give him a bill of divorcement.
For her protection.
I'm sorry, I didn't. Okay. I had to look at it, see, I can't speak intelligently on it. So, Greg?
Okay, so you're saying that verse 8, Jeremiah, when she's asking, then I saw for all the causes for which backsliding evil is committed and offering, I can put her away and give her certificate of divorce. And then you're saying that next scripture, because you're looking for the bill, which would go back and say that he really did.
No, Isaiah 51?
Yeah,
Isaiah 51. Which is commonly understood to have been written after the prophecy that was given later, God is telling Israel, you say you got a bill of divorcement? Show it to me. I never gave you one.
Well, 51 verse 1 does say, where is your bill of divorcement with which I sent you away?
Well, which means basically saying, if I gave you a bill of divorcement, I would have had to have put it in your hand.
It's like a conversation taking place.
Yeah. And the implication is that I didn't give you a bill of divorcement and place it in your hand. Because if you had it, you could show it to me.
That was prior to Jeremiah.
It's after Jeremiah.
50 verse 1 is written
Isaiah.
After
Isaiah 50 verse
Jeremiah 3.
Yeah. And so the idea is that Jeremiah 3:8, the way it's written, it could be that he's basically, it's because of the gender of the words, that she's asking for a bill of divorcement to be placed in her hand, and he won't give it to her. Okay? So because he won't give it to her, and if she's out messing around with all these other guys, then what can be her fate? She could be put to death. Okay? If he doesn't give it to her. All right? So she now is worthy of death. And what does he come along to do, though? He pays that death penalty for her. So that she now is no longer able to be put to death for that sin. Okay? You see what it's all getting at there? Yeah. He's redeemed her. He's redeemed her with his blood. Now she belongs to him. Yeah. Of course, she belonged to him before, but he just paid the penalty for her. Okay. Yeah, the Hebrew concepts are a little bit different than our English Christian American concepts. And so, and there again, I mean, Angie and I studied this for a long time, and you know, the whole thing about a bill of divorcement being given, it's not perfectly clear in Jeremiah 3:8, but there's other passages that seem to support the concept that he never did give her a bill of divorcement. Yeah. Yeah, you can't be married if he's giving her a bill of divorcement.
Verse 14, Jeremiah 3.
Yeah. And in fact, even God says that backsliding Judah did worse than anything that Israel did. But yet, it's very clear that Judah did not receive a bill of divorcement. So, anyway. It's interesting stuff, ain't it? So you wanted your mind to be blown again? get used to it, because we do a little bit of mind-blowing here, because we, just got to take the words. The way they're written. Okay, well, that's it for me. So, let's see, what's next? We take in, I got to look at my thing here. All right, should be right after this. All right, so we're done the reading, the Shema reading discussion. Okay, so let's go ahead and rise, and we will close with the Aaronic benediction, and I think I'll close with a prayer after this as well. And then we will wish everybody a happy new week with Shalom Havarim. Okay. Yavareka Adonai V'yishmareka Ya'er Adonai panavaleka ve'ekuneka Yisa Adonai panavaleka v'yesem leka shalom. And Yahweh spoke to Moses, saying, speak to Aaron and his son, saying, this is the way you shall bless the children of Israel. Say to them, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. So they shall put my name on the children of Israel, and I will bless them. Amen. Abba, Father, blessed are you, the mighty God of Israel. Abba, thank you for all the many wonderful things you do for us, for giving us this fine food we had this afternoon, for giving us the opportunity to fellowship together and to study your words. And Abba, I pray that all the words of my mouth and meditation of my heart is pleasing to you, and that we say the correct things and properly discern the scriptures, properly slice them up, Father, and see what they really mean. And so we ask that you would just continue to be with us, watch over us, help us, Father, to take the things that we see and study into them and become convicted if it's true or not. And so we give you thanks for this opportunity today. We pray that you'd be with me this evening as we travel down to Lufkin and just ask for your guidance and direction upon us as we start a new week. Blessed and holy are you, Abba, our Father. We pray for Messiah to return quickly in our day and restore your kingdom upon the earth. Blessed are you, Lord, the God of our fathers. Amen. Okay. All right, so Danielle, this is when it gets weird. So, come on. You can bring the kids. They can participate. They're all going to be speaking.
Back up, Tim.
All right, back up and get in between. All right, this is really weird. This is called Shalom Havarim. This is peace be unto you until we meet again. And we do it in action, the Hebrew way. Okay. Shalom Havarim, Shalom Havarim, Shalom, Shalom. Lahit triot, Lahit triot, Shalom, Shalom. Shalom Havarim, Shalom Havarim, Shalom, Shalom. Lahit triot, Lahit triot, Shalom, Shalom. Shabbat Shalom, everybody. Have a good week. We hope you enjoyed it with us today. So, if you have any questions, just give us a call. And we have a lot of things that are different, probably, from what you heard before and stuff. And good. We're just trying to take the scriptures, put the Hebrew, understand what the Hebrew words actually mean, and put them in there, and it sort of changes the way things.
So, yeah, I haven't been looking at the Hebrew this moment because I didn't really know what it was when I found when they said this is what it is, but I was reading it, and I was like, that's what I thought. And I know it's kind of a silly question. Do you call yourself Christians, or?
Well, if someone says, what denomination are you, we would say we're Hebrew Roots. If a person asks if I believe that Jesus is Messiah, I'd say yes. And so does that make me a Christian? I guess it does, you know. I don't believe, though, that our Messiah is the same Jesus that's being taught in Christian churches. And when I say that, I'm not saying a different personage. I think that they have mischaracterized the person of the Messiah. And so that's the way I'd explain it. Because I believe that Jesus is the Messiah. I don't think the picture that we see of him is the correct picture. But I think that the person that we read about in our Bible there, we all believe it's that guy that's written about there that they call Jesus in the New Testament, is the Messiah. That is, he just didn't do the things the way they said he did them. And that's the problem. Sure.
Yeah.
Well, best thing to do would be to take and give us a call, and we'll try to set up a time that my wife and I could come. Do you want us to come over to your house? Or would you like to come over to our house? Or? Okay. Okay. We live in Hawkins, and so probably your place is familiar to your kids, so they'd probably be better. So. Well, just have them ask, just if you want to do that, just give me a call. I don't have a problem with that.
Okay.
So.
All right, I'll have him. Okay.
And just to let you know, too, we joke about this pastor thing around here because we have no official capacities.
Yeah.
I'm just a moderator. I mean, my wife and I started the fellowship, and that's all there is to it. And so. Did he walk outside? So anyway, it's you can see we're sort of a layback, try to be fun, try to make it all fun. So. All right, I'd be glad to be. I'm anxious to meet your husband. So just let us know. All right.